Hey, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending upon where you are in the world. This is Eric Rubenstein, and I'm here with another podcast on retro fraud. Again, I am Advise Health's Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse Support, and I work with a variety of clients on matters involving litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. Today, I'm really excited to have my next guest in this ongoing series on retro fraud, Matt Lawhon. Matt is an attorney right now. He's in Dallas. Matt's got a kind of interesting path that he took to become a lawyer. He started off his career working in the SIU space, primarily doing Medicare, Medicaid program integrity work, then went on and was a Dallas police officer. I think I might have that backwards. He was a Dallas police officer first. He'll clarify that when we get there. And then went into program integrity, and then ultimately was an investigator with the state of Texas Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is a law enforcement organization in the state of Texas. Worked a lot with my former organization, HHS OIG, working a lot with the special agents there. So we've got a lot of people in common, and went to law school and then left working in law enforcement to dedicate his time full time to the practice of law, specifically for healthcare. Today is part of our retro fraud cases. We're going to be talking about a case that Matt did back about 10 years ago. It's super interesting to me. It really is a Medicaid only case because of the type of fraud that was involved, but it really does go to demonstrate that the fraud, even though it occurred about 10 years ago, the same sort of thing occurs. And I've said many times before is that even though the circus stays the same, the clowns change. And so we're going to get a little bit of a history about that. Matt, did I miss anything or did I get my timeline wrong?
You were great. No, you corrected yourself. Yeah, I started life as a Dallas police officer, but rather quickly transitioned into investigating healthcare fraud. So no, it was perfect.
Great. And as a side matter, totally unrelated, when I was in graduate school, I went down to Dallas to test for their PD. And on day three of testing, I left because I learned that they had this huge attrition rate. And the attrition rate was due to, unfortunately, a lot of police officers being injured or killed in the line of duty. And so there was this incessant deficit of police officers. So on day three of my testing, I thanked them and I excused myself.
When did you test?
It was 1992 or three. So okay. I graduated graduate school in 1992. So I think it probably would have been 1992 that I went down there. Had I gone through the process, I would have probably ended up in Dallas, and I would have had probably a cowboy hat on right now and some sort of leather boot or something. But
let's not perpetuate stereotypes. There's all people in Texas. I happen to wear lots of boots and cowboy hats though. So
all right, listen, it is what it is. So Matt, I think, so the case we're going to talk about today is a case that I've done a little bit of research on. You've given me some information about it. It's a pretty interesting case. It dates back to early 2010, 11, 12, somewhere in that area. And it involves a Medicaid covered service, not a Medicare covered service. So right. For those of you that aren't inherently conversant in the differences, Medicare is a program that is based upon eligibility. So you become eligible for Medicare when you hit a certain age or you have certain disabilities or impairments. People on, for example, like Social Security disability can qualify for Medicare if they're prior to the age of joining, which is typically 65. But Medicaid is a program that is based upon need. So it is typically a healthcare program for the poor and the needy. And then there are some spin-off things like CHIP, which is children's health insurance. And the way that the federal government gets involved is HHS is a funding source and typically funds as much as 50%, and in some states even a little bit more, towards Medicaid operations, including funding partly the Medicaid fraud control units. Now, part of that is that there are some services that are covered by Medicaid that are not covered by Medicare. For example, in the transportation world, Medicaid covers certain types of transportation other than an ambulance, whereas Medicare only covers medically necessary transports via stretcher. So when you see the wheelchair vans or those ambulettes, those are typically going to be Medicaid reimbursed services. One thing that is also not a covered service in the Medicare world, but is a Medicaid service, are hearing aids, which are very costly. And so those are services that are covered under a Medicaid benefit, not a Medicare benefit. And so, Matt, I want to turn this over to you now, because this is a case that involved the dispensing of Medicaid covered services for hearing aids. So why don't you take us through sort of how the case came to be and, you know, where the investigation ultimately landed?
Yeah, you bet. No, it's this was one of my kind of favorite cases, not just because of the success that we had. Multiple cases that were successful. This was just kind of an interesting case to work. It's a hearing aid. It's a tangible item, right? I always equate, you know, hearing aids DME to say a drug possession case that I would have filed as a police officer, right? Because with other types of healthcare services, you can get into a situation where it's somewhat nebulous. Was the service provided? Wasn't it provided? In these DME type cases, you can point to they did get the item, they did not get the item, or they didn't get the item billed. And it's kind of a cleaner case or an easier case to make others understand. This case.
Matt, just to interrupt you, but cases like that also have a pretty interesting jury appeal. Right? Because when you're talking about the medical necessity of a service, you know, if we're talking about like an EKG, you go to your doctor for a sore throat, they do an EKG, that's not really a tangible. So juries may not get that same sort of thrust or flavor, but something like a DME, a hearing aid, that's tangible. People can see it, they understand it. It's got a little bit more meat on the bone, so to speak.
Absolutely. And that's where I was kind of going with it. It has that jury appeal because of, you know, the concreteness of the device itself. This was a case that, it's interesting because of the way we got it. We being myself and my FBI partner at the time. You pointed out it was Medicaid only. As you know, HHS agents can work Medicaid only cases, but here in the Dallas area at that time, there was so much going on that HHS didn't have resources to allocate to something that was Medicaid only. So it wasn't, you know, I was trying to work a case with just the FBI. It was, you know, the couldn't spare anybody to work it with us, but, we had some fun with it. The case came, it didn't come to us. We actually got it somewhat organically. And that's another, you know, neat aspect of it. It didn't come from a complaint. It didn't come from some sort of allegation. My FBI partner and I were working another hearing aid case on a provider, and we were going out and doing interviews in nursing homes. And when we went to a particular nursing home, they said, "Oh yeah, well, this other guy comes in and services our patients too." We started looking at that suspect, and then interview. And so this was a second case that we opened. And then in developing that particular case, we stumbled upon the case we're talking about today, which is the case against Michael and Debbie Spradlin. Right. And the way we fell into the Spradlin case was one of the things that we had success in our other cases was subpoenaing the manufacturer records. Right. So a manufacturer like a Starkey makes the hearing aids and then sends them to the hearing aid distributor. And so what we could do was get those invoices and say, all right, you've billed for more devices than you actually ordered. So there's an issue here.
Almost like doing a pharmacy inventory reconciliation.
Absolutely. So in order to get on the second case, in order to identify the manufacturer that he was going through, we had to subpoena bank records. Right. That's the way we could see who are they making payments to. And that's how we're going to identify the manufacturer. Well, when we got the bank records, we were seeing that this particular provider was, I believe, receiving payments from the Spradlins in excess of a couple hundred thousand dollars. So we were able to determine that the Spradlins were another Medicaid hearing aid provider. They were located in Waco, Texas. And when we started looking at them, they were being paid under the program, over $1 million in a rather short time frame. So we decided to, okay, we need to scrutinize this provider a little bit more. They're making payments to another provider that we've got an allegation against, and they're making $1 million under this program.
And Waco's a couple of hours from Dallas. Are the claims for patients that are being serviced locally in Waco or patients that are being serviced locally in Dallas?
So what we were able to do is once we identified that they were a Medicaid provider, we could run the claims data, right, to see. And what we were seeing was there was some business being conducted in Waco, but there was this vastly larger amount of claims for patients that were in the DFW area.
So from a geospatial, I mean, these people would have to drive 2 hours one way to deal with the hearing aids, drive 2 hours back. I mean, like, if they're servicing 4, 5, or 6 patients, you're talking about like almost a situation where it becomes an impossible day. Like you can only drive so many hours in a day to Dallas.
And not just that. So the Spradlins only had a location in Waco. We could not locate any kind of satellite office in the Dallas area. And so it was suspicious to say the least that this vast number of patients in the DFW area, DFW being Dallas-Fort Worth for people outside of Texas, in the DFW area, that would circumvent all these other hearing aid providers that were local to go to Waco to get a device or have the Spradlins come from Waco all the way up to Dallas to treat all these people, right? So, healthcare fraud investigations, labor intensive, it's paper intensive, interview intensive. So once we started to see these patients in our area, nowhere near Waco, we just started going out and doing interviews. And what we discovered was none of these people had hearing issues and none of them heard of the Spradlins. And none of them received a hearing aid. So, that's when we start having genuine conversations with the AUSA about, okay, this is a fairly solid criminal case. And we're working to build that probable cause for the search warrant. And we're starting to look
Were all of these people that lived in, did they live in like a SNF, a skilled nursing facility setting? Did they live in like senior citizen buildings, or were these people that were just sprinkled out all over the like metropolitan Dallas-Fort Worth area?
Yeah, I mean, great question. These were people that were lived in the neighborhoods. They were not a SNF. They were not in assisted living centers. They were in their own homes with family members.
And we'll get to how they identified the patients later because I've read some documents, so I know how that happened, but I will wait on that because that's actually an important piece. But so, right. Yeah, so you're working on your probable cause and things of right. that sort.
And to go to that, one of the first things first questions that came to mind, right, is how are these people being identified? And so what we did was we tried to do some cross-claims analysis just based on the patients themselves. And we wouldn't have... We would have some luck, but there was no central provider for all these patients, right? It wasn't as clean as, all these patients are also being treated by this facility in the Dallas area. So that must be the connection, right? There was a number of them that were, you know, at one hospital or might have gone to a different hospital or seen this other provider, right? So it wasn't as streamlined and direct to connect how they were getting, the Spradlins were getting the patient information to bill off of. But again, we'll get to that a little bit later. You know, and again, you know, I could say you've done this before too. You know, part of building the probable cause was getting the bank records and analyzing the financial information. And, you know, part of any kind of white collar investigation, at least in my experience, is you want to see how they're using the money, because you might want to go try to see some assets, because there's probably not going to be enough money in the bank account to satisfy the restitution that's going to be amassed at the end of the trial, right? So we did our bank analysis, and we were seeing that they had this flood of money coming in for these services that they weren't providing. And then they were turning around and buying toys, essentially. Jet skis, boats, pickup trucks. I think, if I recall correctly, they paid off their house. So, you know, in developing the probable cause to move towards a search warrant, we were also moving towards, you know, seizing these assets at the same time, right? So we've done our interviews, discovered that there's no way these patients got this device. They'd never heard of these people, never been to Waco, right? We're actually working this case simultaneously with that second case that we talked about that led to this one. Because what we discovered in that one was that the payments that were being made were because our second suspect was actually providing the device to certain patients and getting paid by the Spradlins. And then the Spradlins would submit a claim for that patient. Right. So a device was provided. But then this guy turned around and submitted a claim under his provider number when he finally got his provider number for that same patient. So it was almost
like a delayed double billing.
That's exactly what it was.
So it sounds like what it started off as is the one guy didn't have a Medicaid provider number. So he was using the Spradlins as pass through billing.
Correct.
Or proxy billing.
Correct.
And then they would get reimbursed, and then they would pay him a portion, and they would probably keep a kickback, a VIG for the processing fee. Right. And then when he got his number, he would then submit a claim. And Medicaid didn't have an edit in place to be able to say, hey, this patient got a hearing aid within the past 6 months or 12 months.
You know, that's really one of the open-ended questions that I never got a good answer to, because in the development of the case against the Spradlins, we would sometimes find that the patient actually went to a provider in Dallas to get a legitimate hearing aid, but the claim would get denied because the Spradlins had already submitted a claim and gotten paid. But in
other instances, it went through.
But with this other suspect that we had, those claims went through. And I don't know if it was the contemporaneous nature of the claim submission process where the program just paid both because it was so, you know, close in proximity to one another. But, you know, there was an edit in place. I don't know how it somehow got circumvented for this guy. So we worked these cases simultaneously and ended up executing search warrants in Dallas for that guy and in Waco for the Spradlins. And so I was actually over the Dallas site, and my partner was over the Waco site. And that's how we kind of split duties. An interesting side note, funny side note. I think it's funny. The FBI maybe doesn't think it's so funny. You maybe have come across this.
I might think it's funny as well.
You might have come across this. The FBI sometimes, or at least at a certain point in time, used to love to get their search warrant affidavits sealed so that they would not be public record. And it makes it difficult.
That's a general practice in federal cases, that the search warrant affidavit is sealed. So for people that are watching this, don't understand the process is that an affidavit is prepared by typically the case agent or the investigators in conjunction with the prosecutor. And what an affidavit is, it's essentially a narrative of the story in which you believe that the things that are going to prove your crime are located in a place. And you get this affidavit done, and the affidavit has facts in it that you don't want to have immediately disclosed to the public or to the defendant. And so an affidavit that's prepared then gets brought to a judge. The judge says, yes, I agree, or no, I don't agree, or I'm going to agree, but I'm going to limit the scope of what they call the scope of the search warrant. And the affidavit then gets sealed, where it literally is physically put into an envelope, sealed up, and it's written across the envelope, sealed affidavit. And so the only thing that's publicly out there would be the physical piece of paper that says, we have a warrant to search your premises.
Right, exactly. And you know, there's certain reasons that you can get it sealed, right? If you're trying to protect the identity of a confidential informant or an undercover agent, I think with this particular one, the rationale was simply it was still an open and ongoing investigation, and they wanted it sealed for that purpose. Because we were seizing assets at the Waco location, now sealing the affidavit also prevents the defendant and their defense counsel from seeing the facts that are associated with the case and the probable cause, or at least delays it. Now we're seizing assets, so part of what you had to present was, you know, the document that shows we get to seize these assets from you. So, right, it's the search warrant. It's the attachment A that shows what we can seize, right? What's the scope of the search warrant, what's allowable, right? And then all the documentation associated with the seizure and the Liz pendants for the property, right? You don't seize a house. You file a Liz pendants, which is Latin for something, right? But it's an action in the court that essentially puts the public on notice that there is a dispute related to this property.
I've done those too. And the benefit of a Liz pendants is that if the bad guy or the alleged bad guy or the politically correct bad person is looking to liquidate, right, and potentially, you know, run away from something, that, you know, something like a house, which has a high potential dollar value, you might just say, hey, I'm going to sell this house. And then the government doesn't get that money. And what the Liz pendants does is it essentially puts a lien to that. You can't sell the house because, right, you can't, the transaction won't go through, because ultimately the transaction has to be recorded at the clerk's office. Right. And that transaction doesn't allow that to happen for the purposes of the sale.
Right. So going back to the funny part of the story, my partner was at the office location. There was another team that went to the house. And despite the affidavit being under seal, a copy was taken to the house and then left at the house. So despite the fact it was supposed to be under seal, the Spradlins ended up getting a copy of it. And we, you know, I think my partner reached out to them and through their attorney and said, hey, we need this back. It's supposed to be under seal. Has anybody looked at it? And they were like, nope, we haven't looked at it. We don't know what you're talking about. But when the document came back to us, it had clearly been unstapled and then stapled back.
Yeah.
And so here's the thing. And
when that's happened, you know, I could tell you one of the things that we would do is before the search warrant was executed, you know, you have a briefing beforehand where you get the troops together, you have, right, a discussion about the case, the facts, so that people get an understanding. And then what I would do is I would take a couple of copies of the affidavit and I would number them. So, right, 1, 2, 3. And I said, I have 3 copies that I've given out. And then I, at the briefing, pass it around. And at the end, say, I need these back. And hey, I've only got two. I don't have three copies. And I've had that happen on, not me personally, but I've been on search warrants where that has happened as well, where as you're walking out the door and you're taking your final look at the property and making sure that you've, you know, gotten it squared away. And for people who are watching this, unlike what you see on TV, search warrants, at least in the white collar world, typically do not include taking entire drawers of clothing and dumping them out on beds and turning them over and things of that sort. You know, maybe on a drug or a narcotics case where they need to really get into the weeds of things. But, you know, typically in a white collar crime search warrant or even any other search warrant, you can only look in the places where things might be hidden. So, for example, if you're looking for an elephant in a house, it doesn't allow you to go into someone's nightstand drawer for something. Like, so it is possible for things to be left. And I've been on search warrants where as we're taking our set of pictures to show that we've got the place squared away, you come across an affidavit and go, oops, let me, you know, make sure I get that.
Yeah, and so my partner a couple of days after the search calls me in a panic and is like, somebody left a copy of the affidavit and now the Spradlins know everything. And I just laughed. I thought that was funny. My partner was a little bit taken aback by the fact that I was laughing and because she's, you know, people have been disciplined and maybe even fired over stuff like this. And I said, whoever did this, I hope to God that they get nothing done to them. You know, mistakes happen, but also from more of a braggadocious kind of standpoint, I couldn't care less if they knew everything that we had done, because I felt we had done such a great job in investigating the case that there was no way they could explain away all this, you know, allegedly fraudulent conduct, right? So if they knew everything, fine, I don't care, you know, whatever, it is what it is, we'll move on. But yeah, so we wrapped up the searches, we got some of the toys, right? Fatherland Liz pendants. And then of course comes the fun part where you as the investigators have to go all through all the evidence. And in a, you know, white collar case, you get lots of documents. And in going through, you know, we went through boxes and boxes and boxes of documents. And then we finally kind of hit the mother load. And the mother load was Debbie Spradlin, who was the wife, did all the billing. She had her own little computer that had her own password on it that nobody else knew. So nobody else could access this computer for the billing purposes. It was the only computer that had the billing software on it throughout the office, even though the office had multiple computers. And then right next to her little special billing computer, she had a little metal filing cabinet, right, that has a little lock on it where you can store, you know, documents. I have one next to my desk, right? And when we opened up the box that was taken from that little supply desk, it ended up having all these discharge sheets from hospitals for all the patients that had said they never heard of these people and never a hearing aid. And so when we discovered that, we were like, oh, okay, all right, we really uncovered some good stuff, right? And then within that kind of
pile, were all those patients coming from the same hospital?
A lot of them were, and we were a bit stunned to discover that. But like in the midst of all those, you know, hundreds of discharge sheets, we found one little slip of paper and it said something to the effect, here you go, honey, here's another one, you know, love mom, right? Something to that effect. And what we discovered was Debbie's mom worked at a hospital in the DFW area. And I don't know if too many people know this. So we can identify people right? And one of the things that that is an identifier is your Social Security number. And in Texas, our analysts for the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit have access to Texas Workforce Commission records. So you can pop in the Social Security number for whoever, and you can see what entity is paying unemployment taxes on that person, and that tells you who their employer is. So once we identified who Debbie's mom was, we could run her social, and we were able to identify who her employer was, which was this hospital in Carrollton, which is a suburb of the DFW area, right? And so we were able to go interview her. We coordinated it with the hospital's legal counsel because, of course, they want to be involved in something like this, right? Yeah. And we're able to talk to her and, tell us about your day. Do you ever take work home with you? No. Okay, then tell us about this document. And, that's when the blood drains from her face and she starts to get really apologetic. And, I was sending this information to Debbie as leads, quote unquote leads, right? I thought these people were good candidates for a hearing aid and they were supposed to come up and see these patients. And that's how Debbie, conveyed it to me, right? And then, and once you start getting kind of multiple people associated with a particular fraud scheme, they start pointing fingers at each other. And, the mom was saying this was all Debbie's idea. And Debbie was saying, well, it was Michael's idea. His name is on the billing information, right? It's his provider number. And my mom sent me this information, right? So, but once we kind of presented all this information to defense counsel, it was just a matter of the defense counsel seeing kind of the writing on the wall and kind of strongly suggesting that that they plead guilty. So kind of a sad fact about all this. I know that write up that I showed you kind of highlights the case. It only talks about Debbie. That's because Michael, the husband, actually passed away between the search warrant and the plea agreement, right? He had a surgical procedure. If my memory serves me correctly, it was not an emergency procedure. It was optional, and then he ended up passing from complications with the surgery. So that was kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Here's a suspect, but it's still a person. And at the end of the day, this is, this was a job for me. It wasn't anything personal. So I felt bad that he had passed away. But
right. Well, so you can see here, I'm sharing this is sort of a Medicaid summary from around the country from what's known as the NAMFUCU, which is the National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Units. And it highlights different cases around the country. So this was a $1.6 million in restitution case.
Yep.
and she got 10 years for this.
Yeah. Huh?
So that, the thing about that is 10 years for $1.5 million. We see press releases all the time. You and I talk incessantly about this. We talk to our other friends, in this world, and we talk incessantly about the loss amount calculations. I blog about it. We've done podcasts about it. It really is something that is a constant discussion point. And obviously in this case, a $1.5 million fraud for 10 years is like unheard of in the healthcare world. You just don't see 10-year prison terms, federal prison terms,
right?
Because in the federal system, parole was abolished in 1986, so it's the 85% rule, which means that if you get a 10-year sentence, you're sitting in for a minimum of 8.5 years, assuming that you get all of your good conduct time and all that. There may be some other carve-outs, drug, alcohol treatment, and things of that sort. But, at least back then, to get an eight, to get a 10-year sentence, which is going to be a minimum of 8.5 years, plus probably a 3-year period of supervised release for someone who probably didn't have a prior criminal history to get them. I mean, that's a lot of weight for someone to carry.
Well, and you know, I think you'll appreciate this because if I recall correctly, part of your background, you did adult probation and did work on PSRs, right?
I did. I was a federal probation officer in Eastern District and did pre-sentence investigations.
Yeah. Yep. So PSR, pre-sentence report is what the adult probation, and they give that to the judge and it impacts the sentencing, right? I was able to work with the adult probation officer that was doing the PSR for this case. And we had numerous conversations. For the life of me, I can't remember his name, but he was a wonderful guy. And we would have these conversations that, you know, he would talk to Debbie. And, you know, part of what they're doing is seeing if she's remorseful about it or whatnot to kind of evaluate where they want to go on the sentencing guidelines. And he would tell me that she tried to blame the dead husband. She tried to blame the mom. She's not taking any accountability, right? And it's just, you know, it really impacted his view of her as a suspect.
So when you know, in federal probation sentencing, in the PSR, the pre-sentence report, there's a section where the defendant can make a statement, written statement to the court. But then, as you know, when defendants plead guilty and they plead guilty in a timely manner, their calculations get some reductions. And so oftentimes you get people that will plead guilty to something because they don't want to go to trial and risk a much longer sentence, but they really just do not take personal responsibility. I've had cases where the probation department gave the appropriate number of points to reduce the sentence for accepting responsibility by pleading guilty in a timely manner. And I have one case in particular I remember where the defendant, when he stood up to make his statement, he made a statement that enraged the judge so much, the judge just cut him off and took away all the acceptance of responsibility points. And so, you know, he would have been looking at maybe 6 or 7 years. And it turned out that by running his mouth, he got himself a 9 or a 10 year sentence. You know, essentially, his lawyer should have just gave him a prepared statement and said, read this and then sit down. The guy got up and went sort of on his own without anything prepared or vetted by his lawyer. So
in that same vein, right, her sentencing was scheduled for a certain day and certain time. I think she was 45 minutes late to the sentencing hearing. You know this. Federal judges, well, judges, period, don't like to be kept waiting. So that, I think that had an impact on it. And then she gets up to try to make her statement. And, you know, she again doesn't take responsibility. And then I actually got to testify at this sentencing hearing. And I was able to present some kind of financial information when she's sitting here, when she was sitting there, you know, trying to make everybody else, put everybody else to blame for this fraud scheme. I was able to come back with some financial information that showed these distributions that were being made to her family members. So she bought, you know, her son toys. She bought, you know, her, you know, daughter, gave her daughter this money, right? And nothing went to, say, her husband, to Michael's side of the family or anything like that. So, you know, it was really Debbie was enriching herself and her family's life through this fraud scheme. And then again, when you keep a federal judge waiting for 45 minutes on sentencing, not only did she get 10 years, but she got taken into custody right then and there.
Wow. And that's another one that's usually pretty rare in white collar cases, healthcare cases. Apparently, the justice in Texas is swift and decisive. So in the interest of time, so a couple of things that make this a great retro fraud discussion going forward is, you know, the fact that so you get the identity theft, essentially, is there's an identity theft, right? The patient's information was being stolen by the mother for the purposes of giving it to the daughter, who ultimately submitted claims that were false. I know that when I was an agent in New York, we had agents in our region that were working cases where, in a similar vein, these organized fraud groups that were doing primarily DME, because that's an easy thing to do, right? Yep. You're not providing the item or service. It's an easier thing to do. What they were doing was they were paying clerks in the file rooms of hospitals, no different than this situation. It was a mother-daughter. In this case, these organized crime groups had identified individuals who are typically just clerks in a file room, and they're just moving paper from one place to another, and they're probably not well paid. You know, you're talking about people that are making $10 or $12 an hour for a job with, you know, with a good benefit package or whatever. And so someone comes and says to them, hey, for every 100 names you get me, I'll give you $1,000. You just need to make copies of the face sheets or snap a picture of them. So that continues to go on with the identity theft. And obviously, in a more modern era, we're talking about breaches and HIPAA violations that occur, right? So you've got, you know, in this case, it was the mother just doing old school HIPAA breaches and old school data theft. So those continue to go on. The proxy billing, so the one vendor going through, you know, Debbie. You know, I had a very big case where the provider was a cardiologist who was under a prepayment review, which meant that every claim he submitted had to be supported by documentation. So what he would do was he would do the service in his office. He would write up his note or do whatever. And then he had a friend who had a business. And so the friend would submit the claims as if the friend rendered the service. What got him caught in part was during another investigation I was working on, we had gotten some records from the friend, and in the records from the friend were copies of documents from the cardiologist. It made no sense. The cardiologist, who it's public record, his name is Shashi Agarwal, he wound up getting caught up as well in a kickback case that I had worked on, where we had him on video taking kickbacks. So he was doing kickbacks, he was doing, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. But, you know, it just really goes to show that, you know, as these schemes go on, that they really morph themselves into things that are with the times, but they don't ostensibly change. Like the investigative techniques of matching up billings and trying to identify, you know, this, I'm a little surprised that in some data match, no one was able to identify that the patients were all from the same hospital. You know, whether or not there was a data match that was done to do that, or if anybody thought of that. I think today's analytics, they're doing that more robustly.
Well, and you know, that's one of the investigative strategies that we incorporated, right? But the way it works is there's no like a single billing number for a hospital, right? And so, what we originally did was, we have this subset of patients that seem to have all came from this one hospital, but if they went to like the physical therapy unit of the hospital, it might pop up as a different kind of provider number, provider name, even though it's all an umbrella entity. And so we had, you know, patients that we could identify going to similar same providers. It wasn't really until we, you know, found that note, found the discharge sheets, talked to the mother. And I think what we also heard, we couldn't verify, was that somebody else was sending her information as well, which is why, you know, not every single patient came out of this hospital system. But Debbie being Debbie wasn't going to, you know, flip on anybody or give any information or say, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, there's typically, you know, they say there's no honor amongst thieves. Right. And they typically say that, you know, a secret is only kept between two people if one is dead.
Right.
And not that I'm making light of it, but in this case, the husband was dead. So it makes it easy to provide a scapegoat for someone who couldn't. Who couldn't defend themselves. So, so it sounds like, it was a great case, notwithstanding the fact that the affidavit was disclosed, it obviously didn't change anything. And you're right. If you have a strong case and the affidavit, reflects that strength and the search warrant is just for, some additional things, you know, in this case, it sounds like really the only thing that came out that was the important piece were those discharge papers and the note from mom. Usually in a healthcare case, there's smoking guns aren't usually prevalent.
Right.
Usually, you know, putting a bunch of things together to come up with what that case really is. But look at the sound. It was a great case. Obviously, $1.5 million in Medicaid fraud is great. You don't see cases that are usually large sums of money in Medicaid because Medicaid is the payer of last resort. It pays, typically pennies on the dollar to the Medicaid fee schedule. In some instances, the reimbursement rates are fairly low, which is why, unfortunately, some doctors don't participate in Medicaid because they'd rather have a room full of people that are paying premium their insurance is premium pay versus Medicaid. Right. But, obviously, hearing aids are a unique piece of the puzzle. So you're not really dealing with a large Medicare population. You'd be dealing with a commercial population. The only time I could think of where you'd be dealing with a Medicare population is if the Medicare beneficiary has a secondary insurance, and that's like an added benefit. Like sometimes you'll see dental or vision or something like that.
Medicare Advantage, something like that.
Right. Either a secondary, right. And a Medicare Advantage plan or, Medicare HMO, where the inducement to getting people to get into, and inducement is a bad word, I know, but the inducement, the carrot and the stick to getting people to join a Medicare Advantage plan versus traditional is that some of those plans have additional benefits that traditional Medicare wouldn't cover, such as dental, vision, hearing aids, and the like. But, people, if you're watching TV, you see those commercials for hearing aids, the top end hearing aids are thousands of dollars. They're not cheap. I mean, a good set of hearing aids could be $3,000 or $4,000, and they have to be replaced every handful of years. So, when you hear $1.5 million in Medicaid, it's not because the service was a cheap service. Medicaid still has to pay. There has to be a commercially, reasonable payment made to cover the cost of the product.
Yeah, and that was kind of why I like this case so much. There were so many components about it that were enjoyable. I thought, to brag a little bit, I thought it was kind of a good catch on our part in identifying the case originally, right? Going back to paying attention, mm-hmm. nursing home workers were saying, oh, well, this other guy is coming in here too and servicing our patients, and to move on that, and then seeing these payments through the bank records, and then finally finding that one little piece of information that kind of tied it all together, in the search, the note from mom, and right. being able to seize the assets, right? It's sometimes not always as clear cut when you're doing the tracing for a money laundering case. But this one was so egregious. It was money comes in, money goes out for, a new truck. And then, like you pointed out, to get 10 years on a plea deal and then have her go immediately into custody. It was, so much of this case, at least in my experience, was unique. So,
yeah, that's crazy. Well, listen, we're just about out of time. I do want to thank you. It was always when I have conversations with you about stuff like this, it's always a lot of fun to hear the stories, see how they relate back and forth to things. And it really is true that in a lot of ways that things that occur in one part of the country occur in other parts of the country. They may morph a little, but they stay the same. But more importantly is that, because I'm really calling this the Retro Fraud Podcast, that the schemes ostensibly are the same. It's really plug and play. I often joke that the press releases that the U.S. Attorney's Office puts out on their healthcare fraud cases are sometimes the playbook by which future fraudsters are going to rely upon.
Right.
It is what it is.
No, I think you hit it really on the head, the retro aspect of it. I bet cases that you worked when you first caught on as a baby agent in the 90s, you were still working when you retired, only a couple of years ago.
That's true.
And that as technology improves, the fraudsters just, execute the same fraud scheme, but have just incorporated or adjusted for any new technology. So, I mean, right. You're right. What is it? It's the circus doesn't change, just the clown.
That's right. The circus doesn't change, just the clowns. Exactly. Feel free to use that on a future legal. Put that in a brief that you're doing. Well, listen, Matt, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. I appreciate all this insight. I look forward to having you back on again where we can talk about a bunch of other cases. Maybe we'll do a little analysis of some policy things, whatever. We'll see where this goes. But think about some other cases and we'll meet again soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure. I love our conversations. The insight that you provide me, I think you make me a better attorney because of the conversations that we get to have. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll see you at the next one.